There's a new Marvel out that's supposed to be nuts. We should go see that.
My ex-boyfriend, Devin, he invited me out for a drink tonight. So.
Stevie, your mom's abandoning us. It's just you and I. We gotta go see that Marvel tonight.
I already saw it. It's sort of...
Ah, don't spoil it. Do not spoil it. What's going on?
Hello. How are you? You're all very welcome along here to the top 10 movies of 2025 as decided by me, your boy TT. We do this annually if you're new to the pod or you're a new listener. I've known this for about 3 years now for reasons I don't really know. I just decided 1 year. Gotta make a list. I think maybe it gives me the opportunity to talk about a lot of movies that I quite enjoy without Andy's eyes glazing over. And you know what? It doesn't matter if he doesn't listen to it. You folks out there, if you like movies, maybe you take on a little bit of what I'm saying and enjoy finding out, do you feel the same way? 2025, I think, was a very, very strong year for movies. I said this on the pod a couple of weeks ago. Normally when I'm making my list, I go by my Letterboxd ratings and stuff, and normally at number 10 I can sneak a little 4-star in there. The rest of the 9 are always 4.5 or 5. This year I think it's down to like number 15 or 16 on my list that I have them all as 4.5 stars. So you're getting the creme de la creme here, and it is negligible the ones that didn't make the cut. I might go through them at the end. But before maybe we get into the countdown, I'll talk about some movies of this year that I really thought were going to be, like, for me, going to be big hits, and they just underwhelmed me. So, first one of those being was Mickey 17. So listen to this, right? We got, you know, Bong Joon-ho, who has, you know, just... It's his first film since Parasite in 2019, which is a goddamn masterpiece, Imho. And he's doing a movie with Robert Pattinson, Mark Ruffalo, Toni Collette, Steven Yeun. There's a laundry list of supporting actors in it. And I think it's Robert Pattinson. The premise is he is an expendable. He signs up to like leave Earth because he has debt. And he signed up to be an expendable. So they clone him over and over again. To like, you know, he's testing stuff outside the spaceship or whatever. That premise alone, I was like, this looks great. And it just fell flat. The satire fell flat. It was very broad. The filmmaking wasn't there that I would associate with director Bong. Just was not for me. Maybe my biggest disappointment of the year. Another one that hugely disappointed me was Catherine Bigelow's movie for Netflix called A House of Dynamite, and which is essentially what happens in real time if a nuclear warhead is launched at the United States, and it's, you know, covering their reaction and can they shoot something out of the sky to block it, etc., etc. But you're in like the control room. You're in the control room, but it jumps around a lot with other people. It's got a very solid cast. It's got Rebecca Ferguson, Tracy Letts, Idris Elba, a bunch. There's like 50 people that are all like, oh, they're all really good. And first half an hour, I think it's about 100 minutes, you know, an hour 40-ish. First half an hour is the Rebecca Ferguson piece, and they're locked in, unbelievable. And, you know, you see them on these Zoom screens and stuff, so they're all cross-coordinating. And then the second half an hour is you're from Tracy Letts's, you know, POV, who's a general, and a couple other people's, but like he's one of the stronger characters in it. And I'm like, okay, but we're just doing the same things from a different point of view. Okay. And all this while you can see like the president's screen is black and you can hear Idris utter a couple of lines. And then it starts over again and you get it from Idris's point of view, the president's point. And at that point I was like, oh, fuck off. Fuck this movie. It's a big tease, you know. Get me all worked up here at the start and we just slow down and start back over again. So I didn't enjoy it, and, you know, glad that the wider consensus was that it was not ready for prime time, if you get me. A couple other ones, The Running Man by Edgar Wright, who, you know, I love the Cornetto trilogy by Edgar Wright. I love Spaced. I like Baby Driver quite a bit. I don't know what's going on with him at the moment, man. He seems to have, to quote Austin Powers, lost his mojo. And Glenn Powell is in the movie, and it's kind of his first leading man solo role, you know, post the success of Twisters, where he was kind of the co-lead in it. He's very good, very charismatic in Twisters. And this, you know, they make his character, like, super angry. And that, to me, is not playing to his strengths. He should be charming. He should be funny, you know. And if you've seen Hitman, you know he likes to wear disguises. He does hit the disguises in this. But it just did not work for me. And it was... Powell will be fine, you know. He'll be fine. He's friends with TC. Top Gun 3, whatever, you know. And he's got a few other things lined up. But I was just like, didn't make a lot of money. Wasn't critically... you know, reviewed well, and I'd say he's kind of innocent, but like, I don't know, something going on with Edgar Wright that it was just really wasn't that entertaining, and he's normally very entertaining. Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro, Snorfest, I don't see it, it's up for like 9 Oscars, didn't enjoy, this is me being very flippant of it, but like, didn't really enjoy it, and I'm a huge GDT fan. Oscar Isaac is in this, my man. You got Christoph Waltz doing creepy shit in it, which is always kind of good, but it just really went on too long. Some of the practical effects are amazing, and I know that it might win a bunch of Oscars for that, but it was too long. Jacob Elordi as Frankenstein, like, he's up for Best Supporting Actor. I'm missing something. I'm missing something with it. And it was just, yeah, a shame, you know. It was another one that was sitting right there for me on Netflix. A director I love and some actors that I love, and it just did not do it for me, I'm afraid. So yeah, there's a few others in there, but those are the big glaring ones I could think of that didn't, and Honey Don't. So you know me, I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. This movie is directed by Ethan Coen, one of the Coen Brothers, who he's re-teamed up with Margaret Qualley. They did Drive Away Dolls last year, which I've seen it twice. First time I thought I liked it okay. Second time it actually jumped up for me. I thought it was really good. This movie is the worst Coen Brothers movie I've ever seen. Maybe second worst. You know, if you're including all their solo stuff and all. Maybe The Lady Killers is worse. But this is just boring. Like, it's so... You have Chris Pine... not Chris Pine. Chris Evans, excuse me. Get my Chris's mixed up. Chris Evans playing like a kind of sleazy preacher. You know, that should be fun. Margaret Qualley is kind of doing, I don't know, Sam Spade. She's trying to be, you know, she's going to be a deadpan detective. And, you know, Aubrey Plaza is her love interest. She's a lesbian in this one again. And she was a lesbian in the last one. There's some funny stuff. If you read up on Ethan Coen and his wife, Trisha Cook's marriage, it's interesting. I'll leave it at that. But it was boring. It's the worst thing a Coen Brothers movie can ever be, is boring and not funny. And yeah, just get back together, lads. Please. I'm begging you. Get back together, because you make magic. And when you're apart, Tragedy of Macbeth was good, but not great. Driveway Dolls, again, different flavor of good, but not great. This is really bad, in my opinion. So, you know, do us all a favor, get back together. But now onto the good stuff. We'll kick it off at number 10, which is a movie that the premise alone had me hooked, and when you dig into it more, it's very interesting. It is by an Iranian filmmaker, Jafar Panahi. This is It Was Just an Accident.
قشنگه رو پیدا کردم. موسیقی
که پاگوروزه آورده اینجا.
آب بیاری.
مطمئنی خودشه؟
فقط میخوام کمکم کنی. افتادم تو شک. شما ببینی خودشه یا نه؟
من یکی تو نفهم این خودشه یا نه دست بردار نیستم.
بریم بالا.
Okay, I'm going to do something slightly different this year, and I'm going to start out each pick by reading the premise, or the logline, whatever you want to call it, from IMDb. So for this movie, it is, an unassuming mechanic is reminded of his time in an Iranian prison when he encounters a man he suspects to be his sadistic jailhouse captor. Panicked, he rounds up a few of his fellow ex-prisoners to confirm the man's identity. Which kind of sums it up there. I remember when I heard about the premise, immediately I'm like, ooh. So like he, essentially the film starts with the captor driving a car with his wife and daughter. And they, I think they hit like a fox or a wolf or a coyote, whatever it is in the hills. And they have to pull in and get the car fixed. And when the mechanic hears the voice of the man who's requesting the service, he immediately kind of freezes and shuts down, and because he thinks it is the guy who tortured him when he was in prison. So he follows him, ends up kidnapping him, and then rounds up some other people that were captured, and they have to decide whether or not it is him or not. And what will they do when they decide if it is him? Like, are they becoming judge, jury, and executioner themselves? Part of this movie is one of many this year that kind of tackles the topic of, you know, authoritarian regimes and, you know, how people have been dehumanized by treatment and stuff like that. This one, it doesn't sound very funny when I am telling you this, but it is quite darkly humorous. One of the people that he rounds up is somebody who is basically, they're getting married the next day and they're getting photos taken. So her and her fiance, like, he's in this tux, she's in her wedding dress, and they decide to leave the photo shoot to come and see if this is the guy. You know, there's a lot of humor mined out of that. It's kind of the question of, like, what would you do? They all seem supremely convinced, but how do you get proof? And he's never going to admit that he is this person that they're talking about. So it kind of strings that along quite nicely. There's something about the performance as well. This film was made in secret because director Pahani, he has been under house arrest before in Iran because of his views on the government, shall we say. And I believe he is going into house arrest again after this. So he was kind of making this on the sly. All the performances are so authentic that you believe they're real people. Some of the people didn't know they were being filmed at the time, like the background actors or whatever. So it really gives you this feel of like, oh, this is what Iran is actually like. There is a great running gag of any time they try and do something and are almost found out, they have to pay somebody, like they're on a top of a parking garage and security comes up and they're like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, oh, we're just trying to get pictures for the wedding or whatever. And then they're like, okay. And like they expect a tip. And it's kind of like they don't know that they have somebody captured in the back of a van, but they feel like they have to tip to, and they all have their own card readers that they just bring everywhere with them. So they have to tip in order to kind of, you know, keep their secret or get rid of them. And I'm like, isn't that just like life? Everybody is just out for something these days. So it builds to a really big crescendo, you know, when they're in the middle of a desert and a man is strung up to a tree and the questioning is happening. And it's just, it was quite powerful. And then the last scene of the movie, like 2025 has had a bunch of movies that have great endings in them, and I will talk about them as we go along. But this one, whew, like, I was absolutely floored by the ending of it. It just, it's so simple, yet it chilled me and also was had me smiling, weirdly. I highly recommend it. I think it is a Mubi release. You could probably get it on there, or, you know, I got it through my nefarious means, but it's up for a bunch of Oscars, so I think it'll be in cinemas shortly as well. I'd highly recommend you give it a check out. That's It Was Just an Accident. All right, number 9.
Y'all going on to another job, or you quitting for the season?
I can't decide. I'm never happy when the job ends for some reason. I just feel itchy inside.
That's because it's rough work, gentlemen. Not just on the body, but on the soul. We just cut down trees that have been here for 500 years. Upsets a man's soul, whether you recognize it or not.
I'll have $200 in my pocket tomorrow morning. Don't bother my soul. Not one damn bit.
That's because you Minnesota fellas don't know nothing about history.
These trees are really that old.
Well, some's older even. This world is intricately stitched together, boys. Every thread we pull, we know not how it affects the design of things. We're but children on this earth, pulling bolts out of a Ferris wheel, thinking ourselves to be gods.
That's horseshit. I've been to Washington, too. Cut all up through Canada and back down again. There's enough logs for us to cut for 1,000 years. And then when the last one's cut, we'll... first one will be growed up as big as anything around today.
I remember thinking the same thing when I was a young man. They're the same thing.
That was from Netflix's other big Oscar player, Train Dreams. The premise is as follows. Based on Dennis Johnson's beloved novella, Train Dreams is the moving portrait of Robert Grainier, a logger and railroad worker who leads a life of unexpected depth and beauty in the rapidly changing America of the early 20th century. This movie will, well, it cleansed my spirit anyway. It made me feel, I don't know, like fresh. It made me want to go outside. It made me want to put my phone down. It made me want to disconnect from technology. It is about, like I said, Robert Grainier, who, you know, he's a railroad worker, but like essentially his job is like felling trees. You know, you see him working with giant saws to cut down redwoods in like Idaho and different parts of the Midwest in America. You know, around the time, I think it's the, you know, early, you know, 1920s or so. It's very little story. It literally follows this man's, you know, a period in his life. He meets his wife. He has a child. He has to, you know, be away from them for quite a bit in order to make ends meet back there. It basically shows how life was tough. And if I'm not selling it on this, you might be like, well, I don't want to watch that. Trust me, like, the cinematography, the way it looks, even the way they talk in it, it just has, you know, it's so refreshing. Joel Edgerton plays Robert Grainier, and he is fantastic. You have Felicity Jones as his wife, who you may know her from Rogue One, a Star Wars story. She's very, very good. She was in The Brutalist last year as well. Really racking up a nice, impressive CV for herself. William H. Macy is back in movies. I think since Shameless is finished, he was on that for like fucking 12 years or whatever. He's back in movies. He plays a small part in this. He's really good. Yeah, it's hard. Life was hard back then. And like, it has me thinking of like, I commute to work. You know, this is very much a me, you know, piece. But I commute to work. I'm gone sometimes before my kids are awake, and I come back, and sometimes one of them is asleep. So I could go a day or two without seeing them sometimes, which is not great. And then I was thinking of this man who, you know, he leaves his child at one point. She's 3 months. He comes back. She's 7 months. And, you know, that hit me, man. That was hard. The ending as well was beautiful. Like, it made me think about like how life moves quickly, and if you don't make the most of it, it will slip away. And I think that's something we should all be thinking about, rather than being stuck on our screens, and I'm preaching now, but like, you know, it made me just think of like, oh, I want to get out. I want to go walking. I said on the podcast a few weeks ago, it had me like appreciating trees, and like, funnily enough, a tree down the road from me, which I would always look at and be like, how old's that tree? Is that like 100 years, 200 years old? That recently had like been uprooted, and I started to get emotional. Now maybe I'm just getting old, and you know, I'm opening myself up a little bit more, but I don't know, this hit me, man, and it's just sitting there on Netflix, you know, an hour 40 or something like that as well. Same with, it was just an accident there, like, you know, 100 minutes in, out, and does not outstay its welcome. You won't regret watching it, believe me. Okay, number 8.
Yeah, I was thinking not just a revival, I was thinking a whole new book. We were thinking 4 or 5 new numbers.
Did I write?
Of course that you write. We write together. It's been 16 years. You know that? Since we did that show? It needs updating, don't you think?
1927, the Vanderbilt.
Yeah, it can be the new Rodgers and Hart show for the fall. New gags, new songs.
New references. We'll satirize the whole war. Rationing, rubber drives, nylon drives. A new number for Vivian.
Yeah, we'll go easy with the satire. Nice. Hello, very nice. Yeah, appreciate it.
There came
you.
A lull, then Cordell Holson orders from above. I'm sorry, girls, put down your pearls, because now we're rationing love.
I don't know how we got Cordell Hall into Camelot.
Who cares? It's funny.
Dick, from the New York Journal American, as enchanting to the eye as Richard Rodgers' music is to the ear.
Okay, that's good. Nice. Good start. Yeah. So, you up for that? You feeling healthy? Is that something you could take seriously?
Yeah. I'm on the wagon, Dick. I'm serious. I've been drinking ginger ale all night. Well, except for this second, because this second we have to celebrate. This is the greatest musical in the history of American theater.
No, I'm not drinking with you, Larry.
Okay. Right. Ouija, shoot this.
Huh? From what? Richard Linklater, we have Blue Moon, starring Ethan Hawke. The premise is as follows. It tells the story of Lorenz Hart's struggles with alcoholism and mental health as he tries to save face during the opening of Oklahoma. That doesn't really give you everything you need to know there. The way I would describe it is Richard Linklater, the king of hangout movies, made a hangout movie set on the opening night of Oklahoma, and it deals with the dissolution of the working partnership of Lorenz Hart and what is his name? Richard Rodgers. So Rodgers and Hart, who were, you know, a songwriting duo, they wrote Blue Moon, they wrote My Funny Valentine. They were pretty famous back in the turn of the century. And now Rodgers has gone to work with Oscar Hammerstein, who Rodgers and Hammerstein become the most famous duo in musical theatre on Broadway for the next 60 years. I think Stephen Sondheim kind of replaces them when he comes of age. But Oklahoma is their first big hit together. So the idea is Ethan Hawke's character, Lorenz Hart, is devastated that he knows it's going to be such a hit, but also he looks down his nose at Oklahoma. So half the, you know, for a lot of the movies, like, oh, it's terrible. And then when he sees the people involved with it, what a smash. Oh, incredible. And Hawke he's up for an Academy Award for Best Actor. And it's his best performance, I think, or one of his best. He's incredible here. He is so not like he is in real life. Yes, they have him kind of, they got the bald cap on with the comb over, and they actually cut out pieces of floor for him to stand in so he'd be shorter than everybody else, because Lorenz Hart was quite short. But he is so charming and yet, like, pitiful in the movie. It's a really nice balance, or very tricky balancing act. And you got a great support cast around him. You have Andrew Scott as Rodgers, you have Ireland's own Simon Delaney as Oscar Hammerstein, you have Margaret Qualley, who is Lorenz Hart's love interest, and you have Bobby Cannavale as the bartender in, because it's all set in, I think it's Sammy's Bar, where everybody goes after the Broadway premieres. So it's kind of this confessional almost by Hart, that like, he knows his professional career is over. He also is lying to himself pretty much throughout the whole movie, where he's talking about this young woman that he met, and she's beautiful and the love of his life, and you can't believe what she tells me. Oh my God. She's played by Margaret Qualley. And then when they meet up, it is very much apparent that the relationship is more of like gal pals, girlfriends type thing than them actually having any chance of a romantic relationship together. And it just made me sad, but also like, you know, had me charmed throughout. Charming is the best word for it. Like, and it's not afraid to kind of get serious and stark, but you know, again, it's like an hour 40. You know, if you guys are sticklers for time out there, it's under 2 hours. And I did not, when I saw the trailer for this, I did not think I was going to like it. And it won me over immediately. The writing is great. The acting is great. And the camera work, the way it just kind of follows them around different parts of the bar and stuff. He kind of has a safe haven when he's with Bobby Cannavale. But when he crosses the threshold to the other side of the bar, he's there with all the Broadway elites and feels really out of place. I can't recommend it enough. I had it much higher on my list, and then a few later entries bumped it down. But I would recommend that you go see it or search it out. I don't know. You can rent it on Amazon right now. It's not on Prime, unfortunately, but you can rent it, or if you have a box, give it a go. Okay, number 7.
I am recording this. Fair warning.
Is that really necessary?
You are a public servant.
So are you.
Yeah. And I think it's better if we just let it all out on the table, okay? I got nothing to hide. You got nothing to hide.
Okay. Well, first, I just want to apologize if I offended you. For this morning or for last night?
No apology needed. You didn't.
Okay. Because if I did, then that would help me understand.
Well, your term is up, and your talent is dead. Now, how can I help you understand?
Look, Joe.
6 feet.
We never talked about it.
No.
No? Can we just talk? Just the two of us?
Yeah, we are. We are.
Okay. So maybe I just talk to your video. Ask where all your deputies went.
Okay, well, why don't I just ask your governor about her little catch and release policy, okay? Because if it wasn't for that, maybe I could hold on to my deputies and the people we arrest.
I know one of them was fired for excessive force, and another one was forced to quit by a YouTube First Amendment auditor.
Okay, yes, that is the same auditor that drove away your work.
Your undersheriff died of a fentanyl overdose.
From handling fentanyl.
And your captain. And your chief deputy took jobs in Rio Rancho.
That was devastating.
You can't keep your own office going, but you're going to run mine. Leave your mess here and start a whole new one.
My number 7 is a movie I spoke about on the podcast. I think it was a solo cast I did earlier on this year. It's Eddington by Ari Aster. Let me read off the premise right now. In May of 2020, a standoff between a small town sheriff and a mayor sparks a powder keg as neighbor is pitted against neighbor in Eddington, New Mexico. That's a pretty, basic descriptor of what happens in the movie. What makes it more successful, it is ultimately low stakes for the most part. But what makes it so successful is the feeling this film evokes. Like, I was transported back to 2020. To COVID times, and part of me, it was kind of at war with myself, where, you know, literally the first scene in the movie is I'll read out the cast as well. It's Joaquin Phoenix is the star, Pedro Pascal is the mayor of the town, you have Emma Stone playing Joaquin Phoenix's wife, and Austin Butler kind of scoots in to be a guru-esque character. All the performances are really good, I will say. But literally the first scene, that Joaquin Phoenix is sitting in his cop car listening to a podcast of some sort. and another police officer from a neighboring county shows up and basically tells him to put on his mask. And I remember thinking to myself, but you're sitting in the car by yourself. Like, they won't deal with each other until he puts on his mask. And I remember being like, when I watched it, the feeling it evoked was like, fuck off, will you? Like, I'm here on my own. I'm not, no chance of spreading COVID around. Yet, back in 2020, I would have been like, why the fuck isn't he wearing his mask? So it really kind of wants you to examine how you acted during COVID. I think it was The Big Picture. The phrase they use is, Eddington is a mirror. You might not like what you see. And that is a feeling I got throughout this movie. It also kind of highlights how much we live on our phones or the internet, and how we are susceptible or to being manipulated, which I think we all are in some way, shape, or form these days. It kind of... The film does kind of feel like a powder keg for a long part of it, in that it's like bubbling up what's going to happen. And then when the sparks fly, holy shit, does it become crazy, like batshit. And in the best possible way, I was hooting and hollering. But there's commentary on like why people do things. So like, for example, you know, oh, and it does have, I keep forgetting this, one of the big plot points is the death of George Floyd. So the Black Lives Matter movement is plopped right in there, and how people react to it. And he takes shots at both sides, I'll say. Like, there's one character in it who is a young white male, but he goes to Black Lives Matter rallies and seems to be getting really involved in the movement because he likes a girl who is doing the same thing. And that, to me, speaks volumes about how he views some posting on the internet. You know, like, it is, a lot of it is full of shit. You know what I mean? There's stuff about here of, like, plants, you know, like government plants that I think does happen, where, you know, they show up at Black Lives Matter protests, but they cause, you know, aggressive reactions that, you know, they're for working for the other side, say. This is the talking point of that in it. And by the end of it, like, it has such a dark, comedically dark ending, that, and there's commentary on AI in there, why not throw that in there as well, but he does it in such a way that I was like, fuck yeah. Well, you all know my feelings on AI, but it is such a kind of dark ending that I was like, I'm a huge fan of Ari Aster. You know, I loved Hereditary, loved Midsommar. He's moving away from horror, it seems. Beau is Afraid was his previous film with Joaquin Phoenix before this, and it is not very accessible. This is more accessible, I think. This might be my favorite of his movies, is what I would say. But I know it won't be for everybody. But it might be the bleakest ending of the lot. Even more bleak than Payman coming to kill us all. Anyway, enough about that. Let's move on to number 6.
I have a purpose.
Okay. Let me ask you something. Do you make money at this little table tennis thing?
Not yet.
Do you have a job?
No.
Backhand! Backhand! Forehand!
How do you live?
Well, I live with the confidence if I believe in myself, the money will follow.
And what do you plan to do if this whole dream of yours doesn't work out?
That doesn't even enter my consciousness.
Maybe it should.
There's no turning back.
Everything in my life's falling apart, but I'm gonna figure it out.
You need any help? I could help you.
You want to go hustling again?
Put your money where your mouth is.
We will find you.
176, 177, 178.
The mouse is
back, baby, yeah.
Welcome to your life.
Mari. I can't support your mother for the
rest. You're not going to have to.
Because I'm going
to
step up.
I'll step up.
I'm going to step up in a way you can't even imagine.
Marty, I'm going to make you an offer.
I got to do it completely on my own.
Every man for himself where I come from. That's just how I grew up.
Hey, what are you doing?
Everybody. I don't think you understand the stakes here.
Find that funny?
I get nervous laughter sometimes.
My eyes
broke or is that Miles?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're my pop. We believe in you.
Hey, I'll rip that unibrow right off his forehead!
You want to get physical? Like an ape?
Come on, he's right here! Come on.
Have you ever thought about what you're doing to me?
Give us our money!
When they do, I'll be right behind you. Everybody wants to rule.
And it's only a matter of time before I'm staring at you from the cover of a Wheaties box.
You think it's that simple? Yeah, I do.
Everybody wants to rule the world.
This is my part, this is my part!
Number six is the film that looks very likely to snag Timothée Chalamet his first Academy Award. It's Marty Supreme. The logline goes as follows. Marty Mouser, a young man with a dream no one respects, goes to hell and back in pursuit of greatness. Yeah. You know, that does not cover the long and tall of the movie. This is a movie from Josh Safdie, of one of the Safdie brothers. If you know about him and his brother Benny, they decided to go their separate ways, and Benny made a movie with The Rock called The Smashing Machine, which I watched and was not a huge fan of, TBH. Much higher on this one. And it is about Marty Mouser, who is a kind of ping pong genius back in 1950s New York, but he's one of those stubborn geniuses that knows more than everybody else and won't listen to anybody, you know, and he's arrogant and he can back it up, but like also self-destructive and you know, all that baked in there. Chalamet is excellent, for the record. You do know pretty straight away it is a Safdie Brothers movie, or one of the Safdie Brothers, because this movie is manic. It is very like Good Time. It is very like Uncut Gems. The other movie I think I would group it with is Babylon, which has some very, not the whole thing, but there's some very similar scenes that reminded me of, you know, if you've seen Babylon, Margot Robbie in the desert with a snake, you know, there's some scenes that kind of bring back memories of that in this movie. You would think, oh, the movie's about ping pong. The movie is 2 hours 20 minutes, maybe 2 hours, and I'd say about 40 minutes, 45 minutes relates to ping pong, or there's ping pong in it, and the ping pong stuff is very strong. There's a bit where he's competing in the UK Open that had me levitating out of my seat almost. I was like, this is incredible, oh my god. And then it kind of, when it slows down in the middle chunk, I think you probably could have trimmed about 15 minutes off it. Like I at a certain point, I hate to do it, but it's the Andy Cantwell ka-chunk method. But I was like, oh, this could be like top three for me this year. It kind of wormed its way down a little bit. Now, it's not to say, you know, it's thoroughly entertaining. It does not feel like 2.5 hours or 2 hours 20. And like I said, Chalamet is great. You get a great performance from Gwyneth Paltrow as kind of his love interest. Safdie has this knack, and it was the same in Uncut Gems and Good Time, of getting non-actors to give fantastic performances. Kevin O'Leary, who is one of the judges on Shark Tank, I believe, he's like a billionaire or multi-million hundredaire. He plays, I think it's like Bic is his company, or, you know, essentially, you know, he's a pen magnate, and he gives this incredibly like evil performance. I'm like, oh, he didn't have to act so much. But he also had people like Penn Jillette, who's terrifying in this movie. It took me a minute to, you know, realize it was him. You have legendary director like Abel Ferrara in it. You know, there's a joie de vivre, excuse my pretentiousness, about this movie that really, like, it's so fast moving. I think there's a stretch where he like runs out of his apartment, down a fire escape, through the streets of New York City, into a pet shop where there's a woman who he's been having an affair with, that may or may not be carrying his baby. Her husband catches him. He has to run away from the police again, and then ends up in this flea bag motel with his buddy, you know. And I don't even want to say what happens next, but like something that made me go, what the fuck? And, you know, this is on the stretch of like 15 minutes. It is electric. And I said it on the podcast, but like, it works so well. It's made in the 2020s. It's set in the 1950s, but it has a soundtrack and a score that evokes the 80s. And for whatever reason, it works perfectly. The score is great. Didn't get a nomination for the Academy Awards, which, you know, I think Begonia did. And let me tell you now, spoiler, Begonia is not on my list. But the score does, not heavy lifting, but it really adds to it. And like, Paltrow is very good in this. She's locked in for once a decade, I guess. So this is her performance for the 2020s. I'll take it. Okay, on to number 5.
Matthew. Matthew, where are you? Where did you go? Talk to me. Talk to me! Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to... That I wasn't able... Wanted to say it so many times. I really do want to say it all the time because I feel it all the time. I love you so much. What the fuck?
My number 5 is another movie that I talked about earlier on in the year. It is Weapons. Let me read you out the summary right now. When all but one child of the same class mysteriously vanish on the same night at exactly the same time, a community is left questioning who or what is behind their disappearance. And yeah, like I saw this film in August. And I was blown away, George. Blown. And I watched it with Faye again, and she really enjoyed it, and I still loved it. It is a thoroughly entertaining movie. I call it Magnolia meets Hereditary, which may be a little simplistic, but also, man, you're scratching my itch with that. Like, it's a fantastic ensemble cast. You've got Julia Garner, you've got Josh Brolin, you've got Alden Ehrenreich, you got June Diane Raphael from How Did This Get Made podcast, if you know, you know, popping up there. Austin Abrams, who is going to be in the new Resident Evil movie that director Zach Cregger is doing. But the way the film is structured is it focuses on one character at a time, and so it's kind of Pulp Fiction-y in that, like, you know, some are set, the end of one person's section, you know, leads into actually, well, the next person's section happened before that. And it is a really, like, refreshing filmmaking. And, you know, this is the year, I think, you can see, like, Fantastic Four, you know, it was fine, and, you know, Superman did well, whatever, but, like, the ones that people are talking about, the hits, are all the original stuff. I think the age of IP is slowly, like, even Avatar, you know, like, made a bunch of money, as they do, but the reviews were not very good. Whereas stuff like this, Sinners, One Battle After Another, you know, it is really, these are the movies that people are talking about. It's very funny. It's unsettling. It, like a lot of movies, nails the ending. It's almost too entertaining to make sure that, like, the themes that he's putting in there of loss, or, you know, of violence in our schools, stuff like that, they almost go unnoticed because you're having such a good time. I mean, that's not really, it's a harsh criticism or whatever, but, like, there is a lot of depth in there if you want to look into it, or if you just want to have a great time and have fun. Like, there's some very shocking jump scares in it, and not just for the sake of it, like, they, you know, it leads into the story, And Josh Brolin has, I think I said this in some of the earlier episode, but like he has one of the best reactions to like a scary dream that I've ever heard, where I'm like, I think I would have, I would react like that, like, you know. So yeah, I'm all in on Zach Cregger. I love Barbarian. I think I might like this more. I go back and forth. They're two excellent movies in my opinion, and very excited to see what he brings to Resident Evil next. Okay, on to number 4.
미국에서는 해골을 도끼질한다고 한다면서요. 한국에서는 뭐라 하는지 아세요? 넌 뭐가 지야?
나는 내가 부러워. 넌 마음을 날치지 않아.
Director Park Chan-wook, it is No Other Choice. Let me read the logline here. After being unemployed for several years, a man devises a unique plan to secure a new job. Eliminate the competition. That doesn't really tell the full story at all. I mentioned Parasite earlier on. This would kind of be the one direct comp to it. I think people would be like, well, if you like Parasite, you're going to like this. Now, they're very different movies, but it has kind of similar themes of how capitalism has fucked us, essentially. And the movie is as such, it has Lee Byung-hun, who you may know from Squid Game. He was the front man, aka the bad guy in Squid Game. He was in a Terminator movie as well, I want to say. The one with Khaleesi in it? I can't remember. They're all terrible. After Cameron. But essentially he works at a paper company and he is middle management, and at the start of the movie he's toasting to what a great life he has and isn't this incredible thanks to the company, blah blah blah, and then it turns out that like the American company has bought his company and are, you know, they're going to make cutbacks and he's one of the ones that gets cut back on. And it's really funny that like I think the first time that a lot of people say No Other Choice in the movie. And the first time it said is by an American, it's like, sorry, we had no other choice to, you know, make all these layoffs. And he then is struggling to, you know, because of the corporate downsizing across the industry, he's struggling to get another job. So he comes up with his own paper company. First of all, he sees somebody whose job he wants and has the idea of, like, if you look at the poster of this, he's holding a vase over his head. It looks like he's ready to, like, drop it on somebody. And he's about to do that, and then he realizes, well, if I do that, then there might be 5 other people that could get that his job. So immediately you've gone from, like, well, I can kill this guy, but I might not actually get his job. So what he does is devises a fake paper company, puts an ad up, and a lot of people answer the ad, and then from that, he picks the 5 best candidates that he think would be up for him, up against him, and decides to eliminate, say, 3 of them so that he would be in pole position if he killed the other person as well. It's all very black humor. But I have to tell you, I'm a huge fan of Park Chan-wook. Old Boy was, mind-altering when I saw it. Last year, a couple of years ago, I watched all of his movies, and he's just... there's nobody doing stuff like him. And in this movie, first of all, like, I love a high premise movie with oodles of black comedy. You've got me in the bag. But like, how good this film looks. Like, some of the shots in this, there's a bit where we would call it a Jaeger bomb, but they, what do they call it? A Boilermaker, where you drop the whiskey in a glass of beer and somebody drinks, and whatever way they're able to move the camera, it's like the whiskey glass is coming towards you. It looks fucking incredible. And some of the kill set pieces that are there, they fluctuate between farcical and tragic. And I think that's the key to a movie like this, that it can't be too much one way or the other. Again, another movie that absolutely nails the ending and left me with a like, oh, what the fuck, but in the best possible way. And the very last shot of the movie is actually stock footage that is used. And it kind of just had me questioning. It has me questioning the life that we all live. You know what I mean? Like, socialism the way forward? Fuck capitalism? Burn it all to the ground? Fight Club? All that stuff? This is so good. And it was not nominated for any Oscars whatsoever. Which, not even Best International Film, which I think is a bit cuckoo, if I'm honest. But if you like Parasite, if you're a fan of Korean cinema in general, search this one out. It's really, really good.
Mind how you go, lads. Don't miss the tide.
7, 6, 11, 5, 9, 20 miles a day, 4, 11, 17, 32
the day before,
move,
moving up and down again. There's no discharge in the wall.
So what's this, Spike?
It's the causeway.
Talk us through it.
It's the only way to the mainland, but we can only get here in low tide. In high tide, the sea covers it.
Can we swim it in high tide?
No. The sea has a current. It'll push us past the island and pull us out at sea. And we'll drown.
Don't look at what's in front of you. Move. Moving up and down again. Men go mad with watching them.
We're about 4 hours before high tide.
Oh, we're doing this.
Can't go back, no, Dad.
Why?
Everyone will think we're soft.
Oh, they will. Can't have that, can we? Come on, then.
Count the bullets in the bandolier. If your eyes drop, they will get atop of you. Move. Moving up and down again. There's no discharge in the war.
One of the only franchises that I, in my opinion anyway, knocked it out of the park this year. It's 28 years later. Danny Boyle is back. Makes me so happy to say that. And let me read the premise. So a group of survivors of the Rage virus live on a small island. When one of the group leaves the island on a mission into the mainland, he discovers secrets, wonders, and horrors that have mutated not only the infected, but other survivors. This movie, it's a blend of a zombie movie, a coming-of-age story. It has themes of Brexit, because not only do you realise that, oh, the virus was cured pretty much everywhere else in the world, except for the UK. So now these are like a quarantined island, so they're kind of left on their own, a la Brexit, they're out of the EU. But it also like has, you know, themes of like nationalism and how it used to be better back in our day, etc., which are kind of hammered home throughout the part of it. Like, one of the things they talk about is essentially the film is Spike, who's a young boy, and I think he's 12 or 14 maybe, and his dad is bringing him onto the mainland to kill his first zombie, you know, as part of a rite of passage. And they kind of say, oh, you know, it's 16 normally, and the dad is like, ah, but you know, I know better, and you know, back in my day I would have been out doing this, you know, at his age or whatever. And there is that kind of epidemic that has infected Britain and Ireland to an extent, that, you know, things were better before we opened our doors to everywhere else. The movie looks incredible. It's shot on a bunch of iPhones. I think they had a rig where they had like 15 iPhones at one point. There is this camera method where, say, an arrow is shot into a zombie's head, and whatever way it works, it's kind of, it's like a video game. It goes through the front of the head, and then like the camera switches to the right, almost like bullet time, but different. The movie itself, you know, it's fairly standard zombie stuff. But like I said, mixes the coming-of-age story. It turns out that Spike is actually the main character, not Aaron Taylor-Johnson's character. And, you know, the rest of the cast is Jodie Comer is in there. And Ralph Fiennes are the three kind of big names. And Ralph Fiennes, it's a tremendous performance. It really is. He is fantastic. You know, you run out of superlatives. I've seen The Bone Temple, the sequel that, you know, they shot the film sequentially. That was released at the start or the mid-January. And it's really good. I do prefer this movie. But Fiennes, these are two, I don't know, they're late career defining performances, I think. Because he is just incredible in them. Like, I can't go on anymore. He makes me cry in this movie. It's a beautiful film mixed in with zombie gore. If you haven't seen it, it's on Now TV. I'm sure you get it anywhere else as well. You can rent it on Amazon. But I watched it again on New Year's Day or the 2nd of Jan maybe. And, you know, I sat there and I was like, oh, some of the stuff in it, they talk, the word memento mori is used quite a bit in it, and it just got me thinking of like how, you know, life, love, death, you know, it's all in there, and it put some stuff in perspective for me that like really I did not expect to come out of a 28 days movie, you know. Alex Garland is back to write the script, and him and Danny Boyle working together is when I think they're at their best. I think I had Civil War, which is at my number 10 of last year, which is, you know, he wrote and directed it by himself, Garland, that is. And it's really good, but, like, I think when the two of them are working together, they're on another level. I talked about good endings. This is the best ending of the year. I'm going to spoil it. For me, anyway, it's the best ending of the year. I'm going to spoil it. So I'm going to say, boots, boots, boots. Okay, that's a spoiler warning. The movie starts with some children watching Teletubbies and their house overrun by zombies, and one of the children escapes. And you don't really see him. You don't actually see him at all for the rest of the movie. And I was like, oh, like, is the dad the young boy that escaped or whatever? But actually they're in Scotland, and the most of this movie is in the northeast of England. And right at the end of the movie, these youths, shall we say, appear and like help Spike out to kill some infected. But they are dressed like the Teletubbies, I believe, or the color scheme of the Teletubbies. And then their leader is Jimmy, who is fashioned after Jimmy Savile, who, it's a stroke of genius in my opinion, because it Jimmy Savile, you know, the world would have ended in 2002 or 2001, whatever the first movie was, so Jimmy Savile would not have been outed as a like horrible sex offender monster, so he still would have been Sir Jimmy Savile in a lot of people's eyes. This guy Jimmy has, you know, fashioned himself after Jimmy Savile's look. Like, it goes from this really touching moment, or like, you know, this boy has had this incredible journey, and then the tonal whiplash of like fucking kids in the Teletubbies colors going fucking mental, taking joy in killing all these infected, and a guy who fashioned himself after Jimmy Savile, who's played by Jack O'Connell, who is having quite the fucking year, let me tell you. But I was hooting and hollering, clapping my hand. This is why I love movies. The feeling you get from something like that. Whew, man, golly, those zombies, huh? Watch this movie, man. Just watch it.
You fellas must be the owners of this establishment.
That's right.
And you are? Name's Ramek. This here's Joan and Bert.
Is that y'all, all right?
Oh, and you. Must be that voice I heard from out here. Oh, it was beautiful.
Goddamn beautiful voice.
Even through these walls.
Where y'all from?
Just down the road.
And how far is that?
North Carolina.
Y'all clean?
Sir. Well, No, we believe in equality and music. We just came here to play. Spend some money, have a good time. Here, I'll show you.
Pick poor Robin clean. Pick poor Robin clean. I pick his head, I pick his feet. I would have picked his body, but it wouldn't fit to eat. Oh, I pick poor Robin clean. Pick poor Robin clean. And I'll be satisfied having a family.
You folks ain't bad.
Oh, Lord, didn't that jaybird laugh when I pick poor Robin clean. Poor Robin clean. Pick poor Robin clean, dog, didn't that jaybird laugh?
Hold on,
when
hold on,
I
hold on, hold on. Just a minute.
Oh, it's just about to get good.
No, I believe you. But this here, juke joint.
Blues music?
We got money and we ready to spend it with y'all.
Sounding damn near perfect, and you're saying we ain't welcome.
No, I'm saying you get down that road, you get back into town. Plenty of white barrel houses down there.
Oh, this because we're... All right. How'd she get in?
And that is she here, because she family.
Family. Can't we just, for one night, just all be family? You don't need to do that, sir. We'll be on our way. But we're going to walk real slow, just in case y'all change your mind.
Y'all have a nice night.
They gave me the willies.
Yeah, well, crackers at nighttime will do that to you.
With 16 Oscar nominations, the record for all, this is my number two. It's Sinners. Oh, my Lord. Back in April when I went to see it, I knew it was something special, but it has grown and grown and grown. Let me get the premise out of the way here. Trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back. And, you know, that is accurate. That is what happens. You know, Michael B. Jordan plays twin brothers, Smokestack. It's directed by and written by Ryan Coogler, who, you know, had worked with B. Jordan and Black Panther, and he'd worked with him on Creed. So, like, you know, they're obviously... together, joined at the hip, they're collaborative partners. The premise, if you've been living under a rock, the premise of the movie is the two brothers come back to set up their own juke joint in Mississippi, and they get all the people from the plantations and stuff. They're going to come. It's for colored folk only. It's their kind of safe haven that they're creating for themselves, and they talk about in the film about like how music so strong can pierce the veil and it can kind of cut through space and time. That's just a phrase that they use. And what happens is juke joint is there is a musician that's so talented it draws the attention of vampires. The lead vampire Remick, played by Jack O'Connell, who I just mentioned was doing the Jimmy Savile in 28 Years Later, is from Ireland. Which is a very pointed reason why he's Irish. According to Ryan Coogler, it is because Irish people and black people in the South in America were two cultures that are very intertwined, in his opinion. You know, and that the escape that they had was culture, music, art, whatever you want to call it. Whether it was, you know, stuff that was created under the rule of the English here, or, like you say, the blues music in the South in America. And for a vampire movie, you know, it has so much more going on in it. It's wildly entertaining. Some fantastic performances. Delroy Lindo is up for an Oscar nomination. So is Wumi Misaka in the supporting roles. Michael B. Jordan up for Best Actor. He's not going to win, but, you know, it's a strong it's a strong sign of, you know, how well-respected this movie is. No vampires show up for the first hour in the movie, I think. You know, it helps you spend time with the characters, really get to know them, build them up, shows you what the you know, culture was like. You know, at one point they go into town and there's a grocery store. It's run by a Korean family. And it's like, yeah, that's actually quite common. It's something you don't really hear about, you know, in mainstream movies. But in the South, that was happening. And, like, this is the kind of stuff that Coogler brings to a movie. You know, these pieces that you wouldn't necessarily think about. It's like there's cultural appropriation lopped in there about community. It goes way above and beyond. He described it as like From Dusk Till Dawn. Like, just, it's so much more than that type of film. The musical moments, oh, it's transcendent at times. Like, there's, like I said, a scene where they pierce the veil. There's a scene with the Rocky Road to Dublin in it, which is like, I was levitating in my seat. I thought it was transcendent. It was the second best time I had at the cinema all year. And when I say that, like, the first 2 hours are probably if it's a 2 hour 20 minutes, the first 2 hours are really, really strong. The last 20 minutes is actually, you know what, there's bits in it that, like, really hit me. But it's just, it's a fucking blast. Original movie, like, Michael B. Jordan, I kind of forgot that, like, how much of a star he was. And there's a bit in at the start where Preacher Boy, who's probably the main character or quasi main character, he's in the car with one of them, I think it's Stack, and he starts playing on the guitar for him, and, like, the face Michael B. Jordan makes of, like, oh shit, like, look, this guy's talented or whatever. I was like, oh, that's money. That's why he is who he is. Fucking, it's on Now TV as well. Go buy the Blu-ray, whatever. Fucking, if you haven't seen it, guys. Andy, watch this movie. Jesus. All right, number one. Here we go.
Despego de mi corazón. Las veces que me ha visto llorar la perfidia de...
Do you know a black militant by the name of Perfidia Beverly Hills?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. And was she a member of the rebel group known as the French 75?
She was.
Yeah. Colonel Lockjaw, did you engage in a romantic relationship with this woman?
Gentlemen, I have engaged the enemy face to face in battle and in the dark alleys and shadows of espionage. I was once raped in reverse.
Raped in reverse? Could you explain how that might work for us, Colonel Lockjaw?
The enemy employed deception. I was drugged. And while unconscious, my brain was not working. But my power was, and I believe it was taken advantage of.
What kind of proof do you have? If you were unconscious, how do you know this to be true?
I don't know it to be true, but I suspect it. When I awoke, there was sensitivity in a private place, and there was some residue of an interaction.
Interaction?
I believe she was a sperm thief.
A semen demon.
That's correct.
As if there was any doubt about what it was going to be, it's one battle after another. Directed by my man, Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn, Benicio Del Toro, Tiana Taylor, you name it, they're there. It's a bunch of who's who character actors in there as well. Tony Goldwyn, Jim Downey, you know, from he was an SNL writer for years, but he was Billy Madison. None of that makes any sense, and we're all dumber for having listened to you. This movie, I was super psyched. We all know that Paul Thomas Anderson, I say we all, if you're new to the podcast, go back and listen to the series that I made Andy watch every Paul Thomas Anderson movie. And bar 2, 3, he hated all of them. He's an idiot. But I brought him to see this in the cinema, and he fucking, I don't want to say he loved it, but I think it's his favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Maybe There Will Be Blood is probably still his favorite. But This is what makes Paul Thomas Anderson special. This is a forever movie. You know, this is timeless and timely. Apparently, he'd been writing this movie for 10 years, trying to adapt Thomas Pynchon's Vineland. And it somehow coincided with, like, the release of, you know, Ice Running Wild in America, which has only gotten worse since this has been released. But, like, you know, the scenes in this film where literally people are just, like, on the middle of the street, somebody walks up, puts a bag over their head and puts them in a car, and you're like, oh, shit. Or there's internment camps for immigrants that are just there. And it's like, oh, the land of the free, like America. Like, not a fucking chance. Some of the lines, like, you know, Sean Penn marching up to Leonardo DiCaprio in a supermarket and being like, you like black girls? I love them. Yeah. Like, the first scene you see Sean Penn in is like, you know, they get the jump on him. I haven't even read out the premise. Let's take it back. The premise. When their enemy resurfaces after 16 years, a group of ex-revolutionaries reunite to rescue the daughter of one of their own. So that's the premise, kind of. But the first scene you see is essentially the revolutionaries freeing a migrant camp that is under the watch of Sean Penn, Tiana Taylor, who probably is going to win Best Supporting Actress, maybe. There's another actress from a movie that I've mentioned already. I didn't want to name who she was because part of the fun of that movie is, you know, when she reveals herself. But Tiana Taylor's first scene with Sean Penn, where she literally is commanding him to get a boner. Girl up. And the look on his face, and then the prosthetic. I'm assuming the prosthetic used, just to, like, the shot of his crotch. It's just incredible. He's like nobody else, PTA. You know, DiCaprio, bringing the heat again, bringing the heart, though, as well. You know, him playing a girl dad for the first time, different phase in his life. He's a loser, like, you know, but he's incredible in this movie. He's so good. It seems to really have dropped off, the conversation of him winning Best Actor, and I don't know why. I probably think it's a better performance than Chalamet. Again, I'm left field. Ethan Hawke would be my winner, but special, like, Penn unhinged, bringing fucking loads. Johnny Greenwood and his incredible score yet again. Benicio. I'll just do a couple of minutes on Benicio. A truly one of a kind performance. I don't know what or how he does it, but, like, he's not on the screen that much. He speaks with authority, and yet it's like kindness, warmth, everything that's there in it. Like, half times he's just talking, I'm like, why do I feel like I'm going to start fucking crying? Like, it makes me well up. I just, you know, I mean, I want PTA to win Best Picture, Best Director, whatever, Best Original Screenplay, because, you know, this is his 10th movie. It's been fucking 30 years at this stage. He hasn't won one Oscar, which shows you how ludicrous. Anyway, write it in. But Benicio winning for Best Supporting Actor would really, really, really would make me happy. There is some incredible long takes, as PTAs want to do. There's some stuff in it where you're like, how the fuck did he do that? Like, there's a bit where DiCaprio's, like, jumping between buildings and falls, like, and bangs off a tree on the way down. Like, where's the cut there? Like, you know, obviously DiCaprio's not doing that, but, like, how did they make it look so good? We got the best line reading of all time by Benicio. A few small beers. Yeah, Christmas Adventure Club. You know, again, if you haven't seen this movie, I'm throwing out random stuff here, but, like, the premise of the Christmas Adventure Club is so fucking funny. And, you know, like, I'm not going to explain it. It's this elusive club, a la in South Park when Scientology was the, what were they called, the Adventurer Club as well, or something? Super Adventure Club, maybe. It's just, you know, they talk about these weird, horrible, racist things so matter-of-factly, and as if it's so normal to them. It just can't help but be funny. A great a great final scene as well. Another great ending. But like, the last beat of the movie, I was like, oh God, is that going to be me and my daughter? And there's a chase scene at the end where I'm like, I've seen it twice in the cinema. The second time I was like, I'm nauseous here with the way it's so fucking crazy, like real highway that they found that's just up and down, up and down, up and down. Oh man, watch this movie. Go if you have not seen it yet. And weirdly, well, I say weirdly, for normies, they'd be like, no, I haven't heard of it, or like, I haven't seen it. I'm like, it's the new DiCaprio movie. He's the biggest movie star in the world. Have you not seen this movie? Anyway, I'm venting. So my number one of a great year of film. If we do a few honorable mentions before the end, you know what, let me get some plugs in first while I think of it. You're listening to this on the main feed, but if you want to join us over on the Patreon for the little fee of €5 a month, you get access to all our back catalogue. What's so great about MCU? What's so great about 90s action movies? What's so great about Ryan Gosling? What's so great about Big Willy's Flops, aka Will Smith's Bad Movies? What's so great about the films of Tony Scott? What's so great about heist movies? What's so great about the movies in the year 2007? And at the moment, we're doing What's So Great About Matt Damon. Our next one that we're going to have up on the chopping block is The Talented Mr. Ripley. We've already got Rounders and The Rip in the can. So join us over there for the low, low fee of €5 a month. And if you can't afford that, well, you can do me one more better and give me a rating and review, a 5-star review. My voice is getting weary. My back is getting tight. So I'm not going to do much more. You can hear it. I might just run down maybe by, 10 to 15 or 11 to 15 of ones that I think you should maybe check out. Number 11 was the clip I opened the podcast with, Friendship, with Paul Rudd and Tim Robinson. I had it further down on my list, and then I caught it again on TV recently. Man, it's so fucking funny. Weird, if you're a Tim Robbins fan like I am, yeah, it's great. It's kind of like 90 minutes, whatever it is, 100 minutes of I Think You Should Leave. I just think he's funny. Just him saying stuff is funny, or him pulling faces is funny. And Paul Rudd bouncing off him as a kind of guy who's like, I like you to begin with, and now you're too weird. Like, the idea is like, you let me get in too close, too fast. There was no rules. That to me is just funny, the sound of that. Number 12, Black Bag by Steven Soderbergh. It's a kind of, sexy spy thriller starring Michael Fassbender and Cate Blanchett. And Pierce Brosnan is in there for good measure too. Again, like 90 minutes? 94 minutes. God, he's trying to bring back the 90s, and I am here for it. Wake Up Dead Man on Netflix, the third Knives Out movie. This is a bit longer, 145 minutes, but it's just sitting there for you on Netflix, and it's got my new fave, Josh O'Connor, as the kind of main helper of Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc. It's kind of like, how do you, the perfect murder, but who pulled it off in a church? It's really good. I saw it in the cinema. I was really affected by the religious stuff in it, because Josh O'Connor plays a priest, and I did not think I'd be affected by that, but I was. The Secret Agent, one of the movies I delayed this podcast for, because I thought it was going to crack my top 10. It's really good, but it's a political thriller in Brazil in the 1970s, again about kind of an oppressive regime that you're living under. And I maybe didn't hammer that home quite so much with the one battle after another stuff, but and you're getting it in Sinners as well. People aren't happy, they're not happy with the way things are going. Wagner Moura is fantastic in this movie. It made me want to go to Brazil, even though it in the film it's very corrupt and hard to live there, but it looks beautiful. And it made me want to be part of the culture that was there, be it 50 years ago. Cloud, a movie by, let me get this right, Kiyoshi Kurosawa. And it's about a guy who's like a retail reseller. And then he racks up a bunch of grudges. And the second half of the movie turns into a bit of a kind of haphazard action movie. I really dug this movie. I'm getting into this guy's stuff. Saw another movie of his from 1997 called Cure, which I thought was incredible. The ending of this movie really stayed with me, and I was like, it left something. It left an imprint on me, we'll say. We'll do two more. Ephus. This is a movie that probably nobody has heard of. I saw it was listed as like the best first feature on the New York Film Critics Society. And it's about a bunch of men playing baseball. But it's the last game they'll ever be played on this baseball pitch because it's being torn down to be replaced by a school. Which I think is genius, as opposed to it's being torn down to be replaced by a mini mall or whatever. It's like, no, it's actually good for something. It's a school. And it's a bunch of middle-aged men who basically they keep playing until the game is over, even though like the lights have been shut off. They just don't want to stop playing. And I've been in that situation with football where literally, you know, I play 7-a-side, 8-a-side on a Tuesday evening, 9 to 10. And there's been times where it is 20 to 11 and we still haven't finished because it's next goal, the winner. And nobody wants to go until we score the goal. And I remember just being like, just somebody fucking score and put me out of my misery. Please, let me go home. I work in the morning. You kind of get that from Ephus. And it resonated with me, even though I have no great affection for baseball. Predator, Killer of Killers. It's good. It's animated. 3 Predator movies in one. Directed by Dan Trachtenberg, who directed 10 Cloverfield Lane and Prey. It's on Disney Plus. Some really cool scenarios there. What if the Predator was in feudal Japan and it was fighting samurais? Hell yeah. Give me that. Give me that movie. Live action movie. And Roofman. Channing Tatum. He's back. Kirsten Dunst. And it's about a real life story about a guy who... Let me read the log line. Former Army Ranger and struggling father turns to robbing McDonald's restaurants and cutting holes in their roofs, earning them the nickname Roofman. Okay, that's enough. He essentially is on the run and hides out in a Toys R Us for 6 months or something like that. Very charming, very human. It's a real story. Tatum is good, very good. Kirsten Dunst, good, very good. Just nice to see him back doing something of substance, if I'm honest. And lastly, I'll just talk about F1, because I talked briefly on it. It got an Academy Award nomination. It is hammy Hollywood filmmaking, but there's times on it when you're like, Jesus, this is fucking incredible, when they're driving in the car and stuff. It's incredible. Probably will win sound, like some of the stuff in the car with like Joseph Kosinski, who directed Top Gun Maverick, directed this movie. The car stuff is great, and like you can tell like Pitt is driving at 170 kilometers an hour or whatever, because he is holding on to that steering wheel for dear life. Javier Bardem, good man. He's the boss in this movie, and he's in a suit and a tie, and he's fucking good. He's having a good time. Nice to see him, like, maybe use him more in that kind of stuff, as opposed to being the fucking weirdo guy that he's very, very good at playing. But yeah, that's it, man. Like, if you follow me on Letterboxd, that the boy toner, THABOYTONER. I have a list there of my top 25. You can have a look at. Naked Gun made it in there. I think that's number, 20 maybe. The Liam Neeson one. I've watched that a couple of times. It's fun and funny. And yeah, I'm tired. Guys, thanks for listening along with me. We'll be back this week. Apologies. I'm recording this after the rest of the pod, my outro. I was gone this week with... I'll explain it on the main feed. But yeah, I hope you are all looking after yourselves, and hope the new year has started well for you. And we'll go again. Start making my list for 2026 right now. Goodbye.
I'm sorry you're going through that, man.
You know we're here for you anytime, right? Sheila's lucky to have a dad like you.
Yeah, man.
Boy, you should know that I've got you on my mind. Your secret admirer. I've been watching you. At night, I think of you. I want to be your baby, baby.
If your game is on, give me a call, boo. If your love is strong, gonna give my all to you.
At night, I think of you. I want to be your...
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you, hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa, you did all you could do. And they say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you. I love the blues. I hope you can stand it.